Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Ray, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio! The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Free people will never remain free if they are not willing, if need be, to fight for their vital interests.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
The Restoration Hour with Pastor Eli James.
Welcome, 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 truth lovers everywhere. Pastor Eli James here. This is the Restoration Hour. This is May 12, 2018. And today I'm going to do probably my last show on the subject of the Jews and slavery. And I've discussed this more in terms of the effect on the American Civil War and how the Jews of the South were totally pro-slavery. And many in the North were too. Many in the North actually owned slaves. And very, very few Jews, as I mentioned last week, were publicly in opposition to slavery at all. They really were clamped up about the subject because they didn't want to reveal what side they were on. So the Jews were generally silent, except in the South where they supported slavery whole hog, so to speak. So today I'm going to talk about the relationship of the Jews and slavery leading up to the Civil War and the involvement of Jews in the Atlantic slave trade. And so this is an article from the Nation of Islam Research Group, and the title is Jewish Slave Dealers and Owners. Now, of course, this is a taboo subject. You are not supposed to know that the Jews were very frequent and some of the main slave owners, not only in the United States of America, but in the Caribbean and South America, and to the extent that slavery was practiced in Central America, a lot of Jewish slave owners there. Last week, I revealed the presence of Murano Jews in Central America and how they influenced politics leading up to the Civil War. But this is going to be a study of Jews and the institution of slavery previous to the Civil War. Again, this is the Nation of Islam Research Group, Jewish Slave Dealers and Owners. Rabbi Bertram Korn, K-O-R-N, makes reference in his essay entitled Jews and Negro Slavery in the Old South to the likelihood that some blacks with Jewish names may have received them either from Jewish owners or Jewish fathers. Okay? And I have documented the miscegenation of white slave owners and black females, although extremely rare cases of white mistresses with black male slaves, but and the masters of the plantation, and especially the managers, frequently engaged in sexual contact with female black slaves, something that Abraham Lincoln alluded to in his decision and his commentary on the Dred Scott decision, pointing out that the state of Virginia had more hybrid offspring than the entire North, so that the issue of amalgamation was really a Southern issue and was the direct result of slavery. So that was not good, folks, not good. So here this article suggests that, well, there were some Jewish men that had relations with their black female slaves as well. So if you see a black football player with a Jewish surname in the NFL, could be have one of these Jewish ancestors. Continuing. The list Dr. Korn uses is drawn from Carter G. Woodson's Free Negro Owners of Slaves, another taboo subject. Yes, blacks owned other blacks as well. You're not supposed to know that. You're not supposed to talk about that, that blacks actually owned slaves themselves. But if you listen to mainstream media, you'd never hear of such a thing. And there were also white slaves in colonial America as well. They were indentured servants for the most part who had a 7-year lease. However, they could be worked to death because the owner knew that time was running out. Whereas the Negro property was actually treated fairly well because they needed the farmhands. Dr. Korn finds 8 of these Negroes with Jewish names who own a total of 39 slaves. Okay, so apparently these black slave owners were set free by their Jewish slave owners and they became slave owners themselves, or they escaped and kept the surname. Like their fathers and owners brought up in the Jewish tradition, they apparently felt quite comfortable participating in Jewish family traditions. It should also be stated that many of these purchases of blacks by blacks, cited by Woodson, were for the purpose of freeing the slave from bondage, as in the case of Meyer Josephson, who stated in a letter that a free nigger wants to court her or his slave and buy her from me. Okay, so they're free Negroes running around, usually in the eastern slave states where the land was losing its value because it was farmed to death, basically, where there was no nutrition left in the soil. And so you wonder if these Jews practiced the laws of land rest. Not likely. The Jews don't obey any of the laws of the Bible. They obey the Talmud, and I'm sure the Talmud says nothing about the land rest. So you could see that the Jewish owners of slaves, if they engaged in farming at all, most of them didn't. Most of the Jewish slave owners were sellers, dealers, slave dealers, and they had house slaves. So I don't know if anybody's done a study of how many Jewish slave owners actually owned plantations, but apparently not too many. So the Jews had house slaves, and they were slave dealers. Next heading here. ADL book praises Jewish slave owners / dealers. Calls notorious slaving firm kindly. this is hilarious. Whenever the Jews admit that they are involved in the slave trade, they are always very kindly They weren't like those evil white slave owners. Well, actually, the worst part of slavery was the transport. Well, first of all, maybe, the worst. The second worst was probably being sold into slavery in the first place, having to leave your ancestral home. Now, often these slaves were enslaved first by another black tribe and then sold to Jewish slave dealers who had sent rum to Africa as dealing as currency, let's say, for buying these blacks and turning them into slaves. So that was pretty traumatic, I would say. And then, of course, the transport across the Atlantic was the worst, the absolute worst part, because a lot of blacks died. It was filthy conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Probably the worst thing that could happen to any human being would be to have to endure such a trip across the Atlantic Ocean. But nevertheless, if Jews own slaves, they're kindly. If whites own slaves, they're brutal. You know, that's the general run of the mill, if the Jews admit that they own slaves at all. Of course, none of this is ever dealt with in mainstream liberal media. Obviously, the kosher press never talks about Jewish slave owners, like the Monsanto family made their initial money in slave dealing, and now they enslave us with their drugs. The article continues. A 1976 ADL pamphlet entitled American Jews, Their Story, lists 13 pioneers of the American Jewish community, 10 of whom have been definitively linked to the black slave trade. Quote, these well-to-do men were highly respected by their neighbors and proud of their religious heritage, states the pamphlet. Okay, now what era? This is probably Murano Jews who fled to America after the Inquisition, and we would have Spanish and Portuguese Jews among these. As I documented last week, the vast majority of Mexican Jews were also Muranos and fled to Mexico as a result of being kicked out of Spain and Portugal, where they actually they had to resume their Murano status, their crypto-Jew status, because Roman Catholicism ruled the roost. So they had to continue their Murano, pretend to be Catholic in the open, but practice Judaism in secret lifestyle, which is a very, very prominent. And still, how can I put this? It's still, that's still worn as a badge of honor by Jews even today, which shows how much they hate Christ and Christianity, that they would still wear their Murano status as a badge of honor, even though Murano does mean swine. The fact that they practice their Judaism in secret and pretend to be Catholics in public is a badge of honor for these Muranos. Let's continue. Prominent American Jews such as Aaron Lopez, and I've mentioned Aaron Lopez as one of the primary ship owners, slave ship owners of Newport, Rhode Island, Moses Lindo, and the Franks family are heralded in the pamphlet as the pioneers of the trade. Too bad Anne Frank didn't make it over. And all have been exposed in The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 1. As slave dealers, Aaron Lopez, has there ever been a volume two? It's a good question. Aaron Lopez, a Newport merchant, owned at least 26 ships and recorded at least 13 voyages to Africa to purchase black slaves. Moses Lindo of South Carolina imported many more. So we see that, folks, this is a Jewish business. This is a Jewish business. And, of course, that book, which I dealt with a couple of years ago, quoting from Jewish publications admitting Jewish involvement and Jewish leadership of the African slave trade, I highly recommend that book to everyone, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. So, and then, of course, Newport, Rhode Island and Charleston, South Carolina were the two major slave dealing ports of the Jews and also their liquor industry, Newport, Rhode Island and Charleston, South Carolina. So the Jews were major players in the economy of those two cities. Moses Lindo of South Carolina imported 49 slaves from Barbados and owned a slave ship named Lindo Packet. He was largely responsible for the growth of the indigo industry, and according to Dr. Jacob Rader Marcus, who was cited as a source by the ADL, he lived to see the industry employ 10,000 slaves. Now, whether or not he owned all these slaves or sold these slaves to white farmers or Spanish farmers or whatever, this doesn't say. Philadelphia's Franks family were merchants in the Indian trade and major suppliers of weapons to the colonists in the destruction of Indians. Okay, so another fact that is left out of the mainstream history books is Jewish gun running. And if you want to talk about exterminating Indians, that is Amerindians, then how many Jews were involved in the gun running that was done here to kill all these American Indians? That's a, nobody ever talks about this. It is believed that Levy Andrew Levy was an agent of Frank's when he participated in giving smallpox-infected blankets to the Indians. Again, the mainstream history books never mention the fact that Jews may have been involved in this blanket trade. The ADL pamphlet published under the leadership of National Director Benjamin R. Epstein also takes the extraordinary step of referring to the major slave dealing and Jewish majority-owned Dutch West India Company as, quote-unquote, kindly. Yes, Jewish capitalism is always kindly, folks. It's only white people, the bourgeoisie, who are evil. ADL officials would not comment on the hate literature, and calls for repudiation of the Jewish slave-dealing colonists were ignored. Okay, so when the Jews are backed against the wall and admit that they were involved in the slave trade, then, of course, their participation was kindly and beneficial, fair and just. The question is no longer whether Jews were involved in slavery, but rather which American Jewish colonists were not slave owners or dealers. See, those poor persecuted Jews, you shouldn't back them up against the wall and challenge their version of history. The firm of Mordecai and Levy operated in the Carolinas and placed this advertisement in the Gazette of the State of South Carolina on August 12th. 1778, State of South Carolina, the Gazette. Runaway, the 4th of August, a Negro wench named Clarinda of a yellow complexion had on when she went away a crossbar check coat, a coarse white linen shift, and a blue handkerchief on her head, and formerly belonged to Mrs. Gordon. Whoever will deliver the said wench to the warden of the workhouse in Charlestown or to the subscribers in King Street shall receive a reward of £50 currency and all reasonable charges, and whoever harbors or entertains her may depend upon being prosecuted to the utmost rigor of the law. Signed, Mordecai and Levy. Okay? So apparently this wench was fairly healthy and therefore of high value. Solomon Wolf, number 9 Broad Street in Charleston, advertised in the Gazette Extraordinary of the State of South Carolina on July 15, 1784, quote, ran away from the scribe, from the subscriber, the 8th instant, a Negro wench named Susanna, 28 or 30 years of age, about 5 feet 2 inches high, thick lips as coal black, speaks tolerable good English. Had on when she went away a blue and white calico wrapper, red flannel, and huckaback coat. Now, if the Jewish slave owners are so kindly, why would these black wenches run away? Continuing with the ad, whoever apprehends the above Negro and will deliver her to her master or secure her in any jail or workhouse so that he may get her again shall receive 5 guineas reward. 5 guineas. I have no idea what that means, if that's a pound or something else. All masters of vessels and others are forbid to harbor or take her off on their peril. NB. The said wench formerly belonged to Mrs. Russell of Savannah and has perhaps gone that way. Okay, formerly belonged to Mrs. Russell. So apparently these Jews, this Jewish family, got the wench, Susanna, from Mrs. Russell. She didn't like her Jewish family and tried to escape back to Mrs. Russell. So now the rest of the article simply details Jews who were known as slave dealers and slave owners. Alexander Lindo, 1753 to 1812, was a major importer of slaves, quote unquote, in the late 18th century. He admitted to being responsible for the deaths of over 150 African slaves in the Middle Passage and 20 more upon their arrival in Jamaica, though he was never punished. That's because he was a kindly Jew. Moses Lindo, 1712 to 1774, of South Carolina, was a wealthy planter and enslaver of Africans, according to the Jewish Encyclopedia. He ran an advertisement stating that, quote, if any person is willing to part with a plantation of 500 acres with 60 or 70 Negroes, I am ready to purchase it for ready money, unquote. And of course, if he owned the land, he would hire white managers to run the plantation. So here, Moses Lindo, if he actually consummated this sale, would be a bona fide Jewish plantation owner. The citing continues. Lindo imported 49 slaves from Barbados in the 1750s, and in 1756 he bought 2 African male children from John Gordon, according to a bill of sale. One of his slave ships was named Lindo Packet. Lindo was reputed to be one of the best judges of indigo in America or Europe. And I think they're talking about the indigo dye industry. He was largely responsible for the growth of that industry from 300,000 pounds yearly to over 1,200,000 pounds. Quote, Lindo himself handled millions of pounds of it. He lived to see the indigo industry employ 10,000 slaves, unquote, according to Jacob Rader Marcus. So in other words, he didn't own these slaves himself, but the industry employed this number of slaves, and Mr. Lindo was therefore directly responsible for all of this enslavement, okay? So these kindly Jews. See, Jewish slavery is kindly, and blacks better get used to that. If you're owned by a Jewish slave owner, he's automatically a kindly slave owner, no matter how many of you perish on the transatlantic crossing. Abigail Minnis, 1701 to 1794. In 1740, many Jews left Savannah, Georgia, because of the restriction against slavery. Very interesting. I didn't even know that Savannah, Georgia had a restriction against slavery. Ms. Minnis and family stayed, waited for the law to change, and then forced at least 17 blacks to work her 2,500-acre farm. So we see Abigail Minnis is a bona fide plantation owner with 17 blacks working a 2,500-acre farm. Her son Philip was president of Savannah's congregation, Mikveh Israel. Oh, no! the rabbis actually approve of slavery. Yes, they do. Minnis named three of the Africans Sue, Lizzie, and Sandy. Oh, okay. Wait a minute. It says he now. Abigail was already identified as a female. They used the title M.S., Ms., because she apparently is unmarried. And so maybe Philip, I get it now. Her son Philip advertised in the Savannah, Georgia Gazette on June 28, 1775, quote, runaway, a Creole Negro fellow named Charles, well known in Savannah. 10 shillings reward will be given on delivery of him to Philip Minnis. Okay, Creole. What's a Creole? Well, that's a half-breed. Emma Mordecai was a Jewish relative of the Gratz and Hayes families who enslaved several black Africans. She described, you mean there's Jewish women actually practice slavery? How can that be? Jewish women? Slave owners? Well, that's what this research tells us, folks. She described in her journal how the Jews participated in the lynching of Nat Turner's rebel forces by burning off the foot of an innocent black man and cutting off the ear of another. Now, why would you? That's terrorism, folks. Why would you punish an innocent black man for terrorism committed by Nat Turner? I guess Jews aren't very discriminating. They then rubbed sand into their wounds and horse-dragged them to their death. No, Jews wouldn't do such a thing, would they? The slaves of Emma Mordecai included George, Cyrus, Massey, Mary, Georgiana, and possibly Phil, Lizzie, and Alec. She said of the freed blacks, they are as ill-bred as old Lincoln himself. Is she referring to Abraham Lincoln? They will now be, now I know where this story that Abraham Lincoln is Jewish came from. They will now begin to find out how easy their life as slaves had been and to feel the slavery of their freedom. Well, I have mentioned many times in this series on the American Civil War, and even as far back as Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, there was really no place for these freed slaves to go. There was no economy. There was really no free economy. They became thieves, or if they had the ability to farm, they might eke out a homestead in the middle of the woods and grow their own food, etc. But it was very difficult for a free black slave. They had to find a place, a city, where they were tolerated. And so that's Washington, D.C. became one of those cities. So it was difficult, especially in the days of Washington and Jefferson. There was really no place for these blacks to go. That's why Washington and Jefferson held on to their slaves. It was an act of charity to, you know, keep them active and well fed and have a roof over their heads, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and a life of freedom for a black person in those was not easy. And that's what she means. They will now begin to find out how easy their life as slaves had been and to feel the slavery of their freedom, because it was a difficult life if they could make it at all. Levi Jacobs was a New Orleans and Mobile liquor and slave dealer who advertised to, quote, buy and sell Negroes in 1819. In September of 1828, he notified the public that he was expecting about 100, quote, prime Virginia slaves selected expressly for this market, among which are the ostlers, carriage drivers, mechanics, field hands and cooks, house servants, seamstresses, and washerwomen. So here we see that the Jews were involved in the interstate trade of black slaves, because in 1809, Thomas Jefferson had signed into law the edict which declared importation of slaves from other countries into America a violation. So the interstate trade picked up, and the breeding of slaves on the plantations also picked up. Nevertheless, as I have previously reported, the black market importation of black slaves into America was still going on in the South. You are listening to the Restoration Hour here at freedomslips.com, simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio, and covering the subject of the Jews in the slave trade and the slave business and in the plantation business, as we're discovering here, and how this subject has been covered up by mainstream historians and is never mentioned. Steven Spielberg will never do a movie about one of these Jewish-owned slave ships. In fact, I can't remember the name of the movie, the black slave ship that was supposedly owned by Christians, was probably owned by Jews. And so Steven Spielberg will never do a documentary or a movie about a Jewish-owned slave ship. No way, no how. That ain't going to happen. So if you want the truth, if you love the truth, and if you like muckraking reporting, which is what we're supposed to do as journalists, is dig up the dirt on the evildoers, then you found the right place, the Restoration Hour here at www.freedomslips.com. And to keep this free speech network alive and well and functioning, please go to www.freedomslips.com and make a generous donation and keep us on the air. So let's get back to Levi Jacobs, and he was involved in the interstate slave business as proprietor of one of the leading auctioneer houses of New Orleans. And this was, the Jews pretty much dominated this business, as I have reported before. A lot of the auctioneering houses were closed on Saturdays because that's the Jewish Sabbath. And the number of Jewish auction houses dominated. It'd be interesting to see a study of, if somebody actually did a study of, the Jewish-owned auction houses versus white-owned auction houses. Anyway, as proprietor of one of the leading auctioneer houses of New Orleans, Levy was reported to have paraded blacks on the slave block that was operated by Levy Jacobs and his Christian partner, George Asbridge. When he was accused, of course, in the South, the Jews and the Christians both used the Talmudic dictate that the blacks were cursed by the curse of Ham. They both taught that. And of course, that's nonsense. Ham was not a black. Ham was pure white, as the DNA studies of King Tut prove. Anyway, when he was accused of selling Kentucky slaves and not the advertised Virginia slaves, he had posted this notice, okay? No. Well, how are you going to know whether the slaves come from Kentucky or Virginia? Well, I guess the Virginia slaves would be, let's say, well-bred in comparison to the Kentucky slaves. So anyway, somebody accused him of false advertising. Notice, this is his response. A report being circulated that I have for sale no other than Kentucky slaves. I beg leave to state to the public that all the Negroes which I have on hand just come to my shop and shall hereafter keep for sale are and will be Virginia-born Negroes of good character, that the person who has stated to the contrary with the view of injuring me, I call upon in this public manner to come forward and support this charge if he can, or hereafter hold his peace. All Negroes sold and bought by me from traders, excepting at my own house, will be free of commission. Signed, L. Jacobs. Okay. So you can see from just checking the notices of the newspapers of the day, you can document Jewish auctioneers, slave owners, slave traders, and some in some cases plantation owners. Benjamin Mordecai of Charleston dealt in huge sales of blacks and penned them up like livestock next to his warehouses. At least one of his captives was named Abram or Abraham. Of his participation in the Civil War, the Boston Transcript reported that Mordecai, quote, has presented to his belligerent state and the city, that's Charleston, South Carolina, $10,000 to aid the purpose of secession, with the offer besides of a large number of Negroes to work in the cause, unquote. So this is stated in the Boston Transcript. Doesn't say which newspaper here. Sorry, I don't know what the Boston Transcript, if that's an official document, doesn't say here. In 1857, he advertised in the Charleston Courier, quote, prime field Negroes and house servants for sale. Yeah, well, they took ads out. They included coachman and house servants Tom, 25 years of age, John, 21, Lilburn, 21, Isaac, 22, cooks, seamstresses, washers, and ironers. Elvie, 18, Amelia, 22, Lydia, 40, Louisa, 40, Patsy, there's a whole bunch of them here. Toward the end, plowboy, Lindsay. Nat, laborer and sailor. Mordecai regularly shipped slaves to New Orleans between 1846 and 1860 and bought at least 102 slaves at Charleston District Judicial Sales of the 1850s. So we are documenting the heavy involvement of Jews in the slave business leading up to the Civil War. Don't go to the History Channel to find this out. They will never tell you about this. Samuel Maas, M-A-A-S, of Charleston, according to Professor Jacob Rader Marcus, took, quote, only 4 weeks to be convinced that blacks had to be watched, disciplined, and if necessary, ruthlessly punished. Well, this is kindly ruthlessness. Slavery, he agreed, was a sound institution. The Southern economy was built on black labor. Okay, if any of blacks want restitution, go to the Jews. They have all the money anyway. The black made an ideal work hand, for only he, stemming from the torrid African lands, could tolerate the humidity, intense heat, and backbreaking labor of the Carolina lowlands. Undoubtedly, Maas was influenced in his views by his uncle and by the luxury of the well-appointed home with its massive silver service and numerous obsequious slaves, ready to respond to his slightest nod. All this impressed Maas mightily. Now, you have to understand that there's a huge difference between the house slaves and the field hands. The house slaves never went far from the house. You have the carriage driver, you have the cooks, the butlers, the gardeners, etc., etc. So their lives were, well, I mean, not much different from the whites who lived in the main house. But when you have the so-called, depending on the how large the plantation is and how many slaves employed, then not far away from the main house would be the slave street, in which the shacks or buildings, they weren't always shacks. I visited the slave plantations in Virginia, and some of them were adobe huts. I mean, they were, you know, not much worse than what the white poor white people lived in their log cabins in Tennessee and Alabama and Georgia. Okay, so their abodes were not that horrible at all, because they had to be kept well fed and healthy so they could work out in the fields. Nevertheless, there was, you could call it the slave street. And depending on how large the plantation was, the blacks lived in these buildings, small buildings. But, you know, and then they were blacksmiths and horse, what do you call it? They dealt with keeping the horses and other animals healthy, et cetera, et cetera. So he continues that this Maz was impressed mightily by the blacks' ability to work in this torrid, humid climate. Isaac Elizer, 1720 to 1807, owned the slave ship Prince George with Samuel Moses. He outfitted slave ships with bondage hardware and rewarded the crews. This bondage hardware is now used in the sex trade today, right? And in making torrid movies. Yeah, black patent leather and shackles. So you can see that hardware from the slave days is still being put to use. He outfitted slave ships with bondage hardware and rewarded the crews of his profitable ships with African citizens. So he actually, well, paid them with slaves, put it that way. He was a merchant shipper, quote, he was a merchant shipper, and like many of his friends and associates, occasionally engaged in the slave traffic. Well, yeah, I mean, if he was a merchant shipper, he was likely to do that too. He was called, quote, a notable and respected businessman. Jews are always notable and respected business people, and kindly as well, and was active in his Newport, Rhode Island Jewish congregation. Elizer and Moses wrote to their captain, John Peck, to sail to Africa and sell the liquor. Here is a quote from that letter. For the most possible that can be gotten, and invest the neat proceeds into as many good merchantable young slaves as you can. As soon as your business there is completed, make the best of your way from thence to the island of New Providence, Bahamas, and there dispose of your slaves for cash if the markets are not too dull. And also we allow you for your commission four slaves upon the purchase of 104 and the privilege of bringing home three slaves and your mate one. But further observe, if you dispose of your slaves in Providence in the Bahamas, lay out as much of your neat proceeds as you will load your vessel in any commodity of that island that will be for our best advantage, and the remainder of your effects bring home in money. Signed, Isaac Elizer. Okay, so that gives you a pretty good insight into the way in which the Jews operated. So they would pay their captains and other ship hands in slaves, unless, of course, they demanded money. But they could turn around and sell those slaves on the so-called free market. Samuel Moses. In May of 1769, Elizer ran a newspaper advertisement, quote, notice, reward, $5, return of runaway Negro woman, Bina, threat of prosecution of harborer, unquote. So it looks like the female slaves were the most likely to run away. Because all of these ads, so far, they're all female slaves. Jewish Maurice Barnett of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, owned at least 11 African citizens. He was such a prolific slave dealer and auctioneer that 20th century picture postcards of the old slave block depict his office at 40 St. Louis Street. He was one of the closest associates of the slave breeding and smuggling Jewish pirate, Jean Lafitte. Wow! I had no idea that the pirate Lafitte was a Jew. Very interesting. Below is an example of the black-Jewish relationship of the time. Of course, now this is probably where the Uncle Tom relationship began, right? Okay, hiring blacks to whip and enslave other blacks. The Jewish slave owners are just as guilty, if not more guilty, than the white slave owners. This subject is never discussed in polite company. Sales at auction. This is the actual ad. Sales at auction by M. Barnett, senator. I don't know of what. Auctioneer Cornelius Hearst versus his creditors. Syndicated sale. Senator is selling slaves so that he could pay his debts. On Monday, the 2nd December 1839, at 12 o'clock noon, at the City Exchange, St. Louis Street, between Chartres and Royal Streets, by order of Alexander Grant, syndicator of said estate, and by virtue of an order issued by the Honorable the First Judicial District Court of the State of Louisiana, dated the 26th day of October 1839, the following slave surrendered to his creditors by said insolent, namely Dick, D-I-C-K, about 28 years of age, a well-disposed man, Osborne, about 26 of age, mulatto, a good carriage driver and waiter, active and handy at anything he is put to, Lucinda, Commodore, Josephine, Henry, etc., etc. No need to go through all these names here. Quite a lengthy ad. Anyway, the bottom of the ad, term, 6 months credit for all but Jacob, who will be sold at 6 and 12 months for notes drawn and endorsed to the satisfaction of the syndic, who reserves to himself the privilege of refusing names as endorsers until he is satisfied therewith. Okay, so these are the slaves offered to satisfy whatever debt is being mentioned here. The slaves not to be delivered until the terms of sale are complied with. Give me the money, then you get your slaves. Aaron Lopez, one of the most famous of the Newport, Rhode Island slave ship owners and slave dealers. Aaron Lopez, 1731 to 1782. He actually lived to see the Civil War. Oh, I'm sorry. That's 17, not 18. He lived to see the American Revolution. Aaron Lopez was the most notorious of the slave-dealing Jews. He was Newport's leading participant in the Black Holocaust, largest taxpayer, and the epitome of the Newport slave-dealing Jewish culture. His son-in-law, Abraham Pereira Mendez, oh, he has to be a Murano, carried on the murderous trade and built massive wealth in his own right. Born in Portugal, Lopez moved to Newport, Rhode Island in 1752, renounced his Murano past, and built, in other words, he was an open Jew, and built an extensive transatlantic slave-dealing empire. Quote, "What can be said about this most attractive figure," writes Dr. Marcus, "is that he lived on a baronial scale, maintained an entourage of over 30 persons, including the necessary slaves and hired servants, and had his own stable and two chaises," unquote. He was engaged extensively in smuggling. Oh, no, Jews wouldn't be engaged in smuggling. And the owner of between 30 and 40 ships. By 1749, Lopez was generally considered to be one of the largest merchants in the country, shipping every marketable item, including molasses, blacks, rum, pork. Say it ain't so. Say it ain't so. Pork. And bottled beer. He owned a wharf, all of his own, arranged for building, chartering, and outfitting the vessels, hired captains and crews, and kept detailed accounts. Lopez, he was a proud Jew. Lopez reportedly launched his career as a slave merchant late in 1761, when he and Jacob Rodriguez Rivera began to outfit their jointly owned brigantine Greyhound for an African voyage, and business was booming ever since. On January 7th, 1763, William Pinnegar captained a Lopez ship which delivered 134 Africans to Lopez's Jewish agents in South Carolina. DaCosta, and Farr. Four captains made 13 of the voyages, two of whom died in Lopez's service. Okay, that's a treacherous journey. The transatlantic voyage was treacherous even for the ship hands. Below are the recorded slaving voyages of Aaron Lopez in the years 1764 through 1774. I'll just name the ships and the dates. I won't get into the numbers of slaves, but looks like the average number of slaves is about 50, and these would be the ones that survived the trip. So I'll just do the first two in full. Sloop Spry, Captain William Pinnegar, July 16, 1764 to May 22, 1776, stopping at Barbados, Jamaica, and New York on the return voyage. The cargo included iron hoops, iron chains, and slave shackles. Slaves sold 57. Okay. Brig Africa, Captain Abraham All, A-L-L, May 3, 1765 to July 11th, 1766, slaves sold at Kingston, 45. So you can see a lot of the slave business was to sell slaves in the Caribbean. And depending on whether they get a good price for the slaves in the Caribbean, they would just simply sell them all there. And this last one, Brig Anne, Captain William English, Spring 1774 to March 1775, slaves sold in Jamaica, 112. So, depending on the price they get for these black slaves, 112 slaves, big business. Big business. Now, for verification of what I've been telling you, the most deadly part of the slave business was the voyage from Africa to the Americas or to Brazil or to Central America, whatever the destination was, because that transatlantic crossing, I mean, you could run into hurricanes, major storms, okay, the ship could develop a leak, etc., etc., all kinds of hazards in this transatlantic voyage. So the worst part of the slave business was actually the transport part of it. The article here states, mortality on these voyages was extremely high. As this passage from the William and Mary Quarterly suggests, Captain Briggs had taken aboard 21 slaves at the windward coast south of Cape Verde, 10 at Cape Mount on the Grain Coast, and 67 along the Gold Coast. So they had identified these various portions of Africa as to whether they were good for slaves, grain, or gold. A total of 98. So a total of 98 slaves was taken aboard. However, as Lopez informed his London correspondent, William Stead, S-T-E-A-D, there was severe loss of life at sea, and much sickness among the survivors forced a hurried sail at St. Kitts. Yeah, because it was very unsanitary, and the slaves were not kept very well, not fed very well, etc., etc. So now this was under the supervision of the Jews, this horrid experience that these black slaves had to undergo. This was under the supervision of these Jewish slave ship owners. Again, nothing is said about this in mainstream history books, mainstream television, mainstream universities, of course, all controlled by Jews. So they're not going to tell you about Jewish involvement in the slave business. But here we are documenting from ship's logs, from articles of the time, and from Jewish admissions about their involvement in the slavery business, that this is the reality of slavery. Slavery, folks, was a Jewish business. Slavery was a Jewish business, especially the auctioneering part, the capture and buying of slaves in Africa, and the transport of slaves was primarily a Jewish business, as you are finding out right here. Sally's log records the burial of six slaves at sea. Sometimes they were just thrown overboard. Dead with the fever and the flux. The loss was doubtless much heavier, as the log does not cover a four-month period of coasting southward and eastward from the windward coast of the Cape Coast Castle. Oh, yeah, Cape Coast Castle was a major, how should I put it, dealing point. And maybe we can look that up toward the end of today's show. The figure given above of 33 slaves sold is calculated from the slave, realizing the survivors. Back, truth, slavery business.
Reality Extraction. On Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Wednesdays and Thursdays, 6 to 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are your hosts, Pamela
and Claire, on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Featuring the public law trust, Lyme disease,
and astrology. Witnessing those who harm and holding them accountable.
Guess what? No more secrets. It's about time we snap out of it. This corporate government is a house of cards falling in on itself. The public law. Do no harm.
Syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I'm seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
What?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back, folks. Pastor Eli James here. This is the Restoration Hour of May 12, 2018, dealing with the subject of Jewish control of the transatlantic slave trade and the heavy Jewish involvement in ancillary industries such as shackles, the making of shackles, the building of slave ships, the liquor industry, etc., etc. So this is how the Jews made their money, having been kicked out of Spain. I guess this is really the Queen Isabella didn't realize what she was doing the Jews a favor by kicking them out of Spain because they got into the slave-owning business. They lost their influence in Spain and Portugal, but they gained money from going into the slave business and owning plantations, etc., etc. So we've been documenting the Jewish slave ships, the Jewish slave owners, Jewish involvement in owning slaves and auctioning slaves in America, a subject which is utterly taboo. But when admitted to by the Jews, they say, well, it wasn't so bad when Jews owned the slaves. Okay, so we're talking about the horrible conditions of being a slave on one of these slave ships where the mortality rate was extremely high. I don't know if anybody actually has calculated how many slaves survived this trip. It wasn't very high. The article, and of course this is the Nation of Islam website, Jewish slave dealers and owners. So the figure given above of 33 slaves sold is calculated from the sum realized on the sale of their survivors. Okay. The survivors, obviously you can't sell dead slaves. Who may have been more numerous than this, but of low value, because of their debilitated condition. So would a slave buyer invest in a very sick and unhealthy black and nurse that person back to health so that person could be used as a plantation slave? I don't think it's very likely. What happened to these blacks? They were probably just thrown away like so much ballast. And again, you know, this is absolute proof that these Jews were frightfully evil and not kindly, as the ADL tries to tell us. The Cleopatra, the ship we're talking about here, was assumed to have experienced very heavy mortality, according to Lopez biographer Virginia Beaver Platt, because the ship had carried a much higher number of 230 blacks to Barbados on her next voyage. So from the slave logs, from the slave ship logs, it is evident that the trip with the ship either leaving Newport, Rhode Island, or Charleston, South Carolina, going to Africa and coming back, this trip took about a year. So the last leg being transporting the slaves to America, and depending on how many stops they make, would certainly take several months. So that these blacks had to endure these conditions for a long, long time. Using this reasoning and simple mathematics, one could conclude that as many as or more than 287 black Africans may have lost their lives in these two voyages of the Cleopatra alone. In the last recorded voyage of the Anne, A-N-N, quote, Captain English reached Kingston on October 7th, having lost five slaves on the voyage, but with his people apparently healthy, that is, his crew. By the time of the sale could be made, two more had died, and the prevalence of the swelling, I can imagine that your body's getting bloated from disease, among the remainder caused a drastic reduction in their value, that is, if they could be sold at all. See, when the liberals in America talk about slavery, they never talk about the transatlantic slave voyages. This is by far the worst part of slavery, is the shipment from Africa to America. They had to endure horrendous conditions. And because it's so easy to demonstrate that the Jews controlled this aspect of the journey of the slave trade, it's never talked about. Liberals will wax profound, and Black Lives Matter and Antifa will wax profound about the horrible conditions of slavery in the South, which was like heaven compared to this voyage and the stops along the way. And being caught in the first place in Africa, often by other blacks of different tribes, they don't like to talk about that either, because those can't be blamed on white men. Let's continue. Lopez's other commercial ventures were sometimes called into question. One Caribbean trader bitterly complained in a series of letters about the quality of the lumber, flour, and fish cargoes dispatched from Newport. Stinking fish, no doubt. Flour infested with mice and rats. Excuse me. Consignments that are often arrived out of season or in leaky vessels, to which he had to give time and attention. Flour too often was of low grade. Staves and hoops for the making of molasses hogsheads were often worm-eaten, and fish was putrid from being packed in insufficient brine. And I'll bet the liquor was watered down, too. He found it difficult to dispose of such cargoes and implied that slave cargoes were easier to handle and more profitable. Dr. Marcus discusses the household and business of Lopez and his utter dependency on free black labor. Okay, well, we had to assume that Lopez had his own coterie of slaves. Quote, Lopez always maintained a staff of Negro domestics and in addition often hired Negro slaves from their masters. Though in his papers such laborers were always referred to as servants, never as, well, no, Jews never owned slaves. They have servants, don't you know? It's all a matter of verbiage. At least half a dozen Negroes were usually employed at one time at the Lopez shop, storehouse, and wharf. So, blacks assisting in the sale of other blacks. For his living quarters, Lopez supplemented his Negro domestics by hiring an Indian woman to wash and scrub, and a white seamstress to sew and make garments for the family and the Negro household servants. Lopez took 27 of these slaves to Leicester, Massachusetts, when fleeing the British attack on Newport. It was also Lopez who was identified as the primary Newport merchant who ignored the non-importation protest of British tax policies organized by the revolutionary colonists. Now, you have to ask the question, was he a promoter of the American Revolution, or was he just protecting his business interests? The man who fingered Lopez was Ezra Stiles, no less. A leading clergyman and president of Yale University. Stiles referred to Lopez in his diary as, quote, a merchant of the first eminence, for honor and extent of commerce probably surpassed by no merchant in America, unquote. Damning with faint praise. Journeying to Rhode Island with his wife and family on May 28, 1782, he passed Scott's Pond near Providence and was thrown by his horse into quicksand where he drowned. A fitting end to a Jewish slave dealer. I wish I could have been there to see that. Next Jewish slave dealer, Isaac Deleon, a prominent member of the Jewish community of Charleston, placed this advertisement in the South Carolina and American General Gazette on January 19, 1780. So, the Jewish community, by and large, is simply silent on the issue of Jewish involvement in slavery. This is because they are so guilty. But this attitude of silence and looking the other way is a definite tactic, because the Jews like to maintain their attitude of pure innocence in the world of crime, in the world of slave dealing, international warfare, arms dealing, etc. That's why they control the mass media, so you will never find out about these things. And that's why they control the universities, so that college professors will never look into this situation. It has to be the Nation of Islam to dig up this dirt. So, from the South Carolina and American General Gazette, we find $500 reward runaway sometime past from the subscriber, a Negro boy named Harry, about 17 years of age, about 5 feet 7 inches high, round visage, had on when he went away a bath-coating, close-bodied coat. Bath, I think, is a reference to Bath, England, because it's a capital B. Coating, close-bodied coat, leather breeches, green cloth jacket and breeches. He is a very likely country-born fellow and speaks good English, so we'll make a really good house slave. The above reward will be paid on his being delivered to the warden of the workhouse or to me in Charlestown, and 1,000 pounds on conviction of any white person harboring him. Whoa! Such a kindly Jew. The said fellow formerly belonged to Boone's estate on John's Island and has been seen by Negroes lurking about said plantation. So I think the trend here with all of these ads is that these Jews purchased these Negroes from white plantation owners. Why? Because the white plantation owners took good care of these Negroes. They were well fed and healthy. And I have reported that the Union Army, upon invading the plantations of the South, reported that the blacks on these plantations were often healthier than the poor whites. What more proof do you need that the white plantation owners took good care of their slaves? You don't invest hundreds of dollars in a black slave just to mistreat that person. No, you make sure that he's in good health so they can work hard in the fields. The idea that Southern slavery was this inhumane institution. Of course, they had to whip the slave occasionally if he refused to work. But the picture painted by liberals is totally inaccurate. The white slave owners treated their slaves well in comparison to other slave owners elsewhere in the world. and they were very healthy and well-fed, well-clothed, and well-housed. Next Jew on list, Isaiah Isaacs, 1747 to 1806. Born in Germany, he was the first Jew in Richmond, Virginia, and a founder of the congregation Beth Shalome, grantor of its cemetery land and slave driver. Not just a slave owner, he was a slave driver, which possibly means he drove them from one town to another, from one auction block to another. In 1788, he was elected to the Common Hall. Now, is this part of the Virginia legislature or town common hall of Richmond, Virginia? There are usually laws against Jews holding public office in most of these states, so I can't answer that my own question here. He was in slave-making alliance with Jacob I. Cohen and held black Africans named Lucy, James, Polly, Henry, and Rachel, and her children. His business firm once took a black captive as security for a debt. Isaacs placed this advertisement in the Virginia Gazette or American Advertiser on June 1, 1782. $20 reward. Ran away from the subscriber. Living in the town of Richmond, a very likely Negro woman named Molly. Now, is she a Negro or not? Very likely Negro woman. Probably means something other than we use the word likely for today. Lately, the property of Mr. Edward Buzbell of Gloucester Town. Again, the evidence is very great that these Jews purchased their house slaves from white slave owners because they were so healthy and probably tame as well. So why didn't they nurse the black slaves from their transatlantic trip? Why didn't they nurse them back to health themselves if they were so kindly? She is much pitted with the smallpox, about 22 years old, and about 5 feet 6 inches. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, she'll catch a lot on the auction block with smallpox. About 22 years old and about 5 feet 6 inches high, had on when she went away a Virginia cloth vest and petticoat. Checked. She had with her checked apron a calico petticoat, and a pair of leather high-heeled country-made shoes. Black ladies like those high heels. I expect she will make towards Williamsburg or Gloucester Town, as she came from those parts a few days ago. By the way, Williamsburg has a tremendous, it's actually intact village, including slave quarters. If you ever go to Colonial Williamsburg, go ahead and take advantage and take the tour. You see what life was like in those days. And we also found a grave marker dating back to the 1700s where, in honor of King James, the name of King James was spelled I-A-M-E-S instead of J. A-M-E-S, because the letter J was not in the English language until the mid-1700s, something most people don't know. So you will see these grave markers with an I instead of a J when the person's name is James. Continuing, I expect she will make towards Williamsburg or Gloucester Town as she came from those parts a few days ago. Yeah, she didn't want to be torn away from her, well, let's call it a happy home. She had 4 horse locks fastened on her legs when she went away. She should be easy to find unless she could get rid of those. Whoever apprehends and delivers the said Negro to me shall receive the above reward and reasonable charges paid by Isaiah Isaacs. referring to the words of Isaacs, the great Jewish scholar Jacob R. Marcus wrote that, quote, "The following phrases are redolent of the spirit of the great Virginians of Isaac's generation." Redolent means reeks. Reeks of the following phrases reek of the spirit of the great Virginians of Isaac's generation. Being of the opinion that all men are by nature equally free, and being possessed by some of those beings who are unfortunately doomed to slavery, as to them I must enjoin my executor a strict observance of the following clause in my will." Okay, so I am a great Jew, and I believe in the equality of all beings. Nevertheless, I have all these slaves. My slaves are hereby manumitted and made free, so that after 30 years, they shall enjoy all the privileges and immunities of free people. Well, that is if they can get a job. Each one of my slaves is to receive the value of $20 in clothing on the days of their manumission. So, after 30 years, and he'll be long gone. Okay, of course, all Jewish scholars are great. The great Jewish scholar, Jacob R. Marcus, and kindly too. Now, for the dirt on the Monsantos. The Monsanto Chemical Company has been developing a seed that produces one crop with impotent seeds, so that farmers will have to return to Monsanto every year to buy seeds. The danger to surrounding crops through natural crossbreeding has the potential to destroy plant life. Let me repeat this sentence. The danger to surrounding crops through natural crossbreeding has the potential to destroy plant life. This is one of the 10 stories selected by Project Censored, targeted for suppression by the mass media. Here is some Monsanto history. The Jewish Monsanto family of Louisiana included Benjamin, Isaac, Manuel, Eleonora, Garcia, and Jacob. Note that when you talk about Monsanto Incorporated, you're talking about a Jewish family, one of the most evil Jewish families on the planet. Excuse me. They made frequent purchases of blacks, including 12 in 1785. 13 and then 31 in 1787, and 80 in 1786, 68, sorry. In 1794, Benjamin sold Babette, a black woman, to Franco Cardell. Manuel sold two blacks from Guinea named Polidor and Lucy to James Saunders for $850 in silver. Now, that's a lot of money in those days. $425 each. So don't tell me a white plantation owner is going to mistreat a black slave that he paid this kind of money for. This is one of the false stories that liberals constantly tell about slavery in America, that blacks are automatically mistreated and had horrible lives from sun up to sundown. Well, yeah, they worked sun up to sundown in the fields if there was planting and harvesting and weeding to do. But they weren't always working in the fields. Sometimes they were upkeeping their buildings, their huts, etc., etc., and keeping a blacksmith shop, feeding the animals, etc. Basically farming life. So he had all of these. As individuals, they were owners of Africans whom they named, there's too many here to name, and many others. Isaac repeatedly mortgaged four of these when in financial trouble. He must have been a poor bookkeeper. Benjamin Monsanto of Natchez, Mississippi, entered into at least six contracts for the sale of his slaves, which would take place after his death. Gracia, or is it Garcia? Gracia, okay, it says Gracia, bequeathed nine Africans to her relatives in her will, so it's a female, it's a Jewess, in 1790. And Eleonora also held blacks as slaves. So you can see the Monsanto family, very famous for GMO and destroying our food crops, began as slave owners and slave merchants. That's where a lot of these American Jewish families, and I use the word American loosely, made their fortunes. And of course, becoming part of the Rothschild Syndicate. And you know how the Jews work together to freeze out non-Jewish business owners. They would monopolize the liquor industry. Seagram's is owned by Jews. And if they had any competition, it was the moonshiners in the backcountry of Kentucky and Tennessee. Manuel Jacob Monsanto entered into at least 12 contracts for sale of slaves between 1787 and 1789 in Natchez and New Orleans, Louisiana. Now, these, of course, these are only the recorded, you know, the ones we have records of. Chances are Jewish involvement in the slave trade, this is only scratching the surface. His family consists of himself and seven Negroes. Later, quote, Jacob Monsanto, son of Isaac Rodriguez Monsanto, one of the very first known Jews to settle in New Orleans, owner of a several hundred acre plantation in Manchac, fell in love with his slave, Mamie, or M-A-M-Y, or Mamie, M-A-I-M-I, William. So here's another one of these Jewish black marriages, or whatever. Whether they actually had a bar mitzvah or bath mitzvah, I don't know. But at the beginning of the show, I talked about blacks having Jewish surnames. Well, here we go. Monsanto. So if you see a black football player with the name Monsanto on his back, chances are he's a descendant of Manuel Jacob and Mamie. Their daughter, Sophia, grew up to be a lovely quadroon. What's a quadroon? Well, it's got quarter black, three quarters, whatever. Can't say white because the father is a Jew. So a Jewish quadroon. An excerpt of one of Benjamin's many slave contracts follows. Be it known to all to whom these presents shall come, that I, Benjamin Monsanto, do really and effectually sell to Henry Monadu a Negro wench named Judy, aged 18 years, native of Guinea, for the sum of $400 in all the month of January in the year 1791, and paying interest at the rate of 10% for the remaining $250 until paid. Said Negro wench, being and remaining mortgaged until final payment shall have been made, wherewith I acknowledge to be fully satisfied and content hereby renouncing the plea of non-numerata pecunia fraud or others in the case whatsoever, granting formal receipt for the same, for which said consideration I do hereby resign all right, title, possession, and claim in and to the said slave, all of which I transfer and convey to the said purchaser and his assigns to be as his own, held and enjoyed, and will, when fully paid for, sold, exchanged, or otherwise alienated at pleasure in virtue of these presents. Wow, this is a really verbose language here. Sounds like he's trying to disavow any debts he may have incurred here. All right, so let her go already. Let her go already. And, you know, when slaves were caught and returned to their masters, you know, the master had to pay fees. You know, I mean, sometimes this was dangerous business. Sometimes these runaway slaves didn't want to be caught. And they would put up a fight and you might get an axe in your head. So any capturer, bounty hunter, I guess, would demand a certain fee. Benjamin Monsanto, sold land and a dwelling house store and two other buildings for which I have received payment in a Negro named Nat. I wonder if this was the famous Nat Turner. That would not have been a good deal. You are listening to the Restoration Hour here at FreedomSlips.com, simulcasting on Eurofolk Radio, where you are finding out about the true history of slavery in America, which you will never get from mainstream media or mainstream historians because they don't want you to know about the Jewish involvement in the slave trade and the slaveholding history of the Monsanto family. The Jews do not want you to know how they make their fortunes and then use that fortune to distort and destroy our civilization. They don't want you to know that. Because they're kindly Jews. They believe in justice and mercy and compassion, don't you know? If you want to continue hearing programs like this, where the truth is discussed and not just Jewish lies purveyed, then go to www.freedomslips.com and make a generous donation to this freedom of speech organ, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. Let's continue with Benjamin Monsanto. So, he received payment in a Negro to my full satisfaction. In other words, he sold a house, a store, and two other buildings for one Negro. Wow. That just shows how little he wanted to work. Maybe they were ramshackle buildings. Another contract stipulated that, quote, Don Luis Faure is bound to defend that the said sale in case the Negro shall be claimed by any other person. I guess there were a lot of disputes among Jews as to which slave belonged to who. In a 1792 contract, Benjamin mortgaged his black slaves. I do hereby specially mortgage three slaves to me belonging, namely Eugene and Louis, aged 20 and 4 years each, the first named of the Senegal Nation and the second of the Congo Nation, and a Negro woman named Adelaide, aged 28 years, also of the Congo Nation, which said slaves I warrant free from mortgage or other encumbrance, as I have made appear by certificate from the recorder of mortgages, and which said slaves I promise and engage shall not be sold nor otherwise alienated during the term of this obligation. So the legal notices of these Jews reveal the extent to which they were involved in the slave business, folks. And the article ends, the following Jews were known dealers, owners, shippers, or supporters of the slave trade and the enslavement of black African citizens in early New York history. And it's quite a long list. I'll just mention a few of them. Isaac Asher, Jacob Bar Simpson, Joseph Bueno, Solomon Myers Cohen, Jacob Fonseca, Abraham Frankfurt, Jacob Franks, Daniel Gomez, David Gomez, Uriah Hendricks, Jacob Levy, Israel Levy, Moses Levy, Benjamin Wolf. Benjamin, if it's the same Benjamin Wolf that I've talked about with regard to the assassination plot of Abraham Lincoln, he would have moved from New York to Charleston, South Carolina, if that's the case. Could be unrelated because there's heavy, huge synagogue presence in Charleston, South Carolina as well, etc., etc. Moses Sixus Solomon, again, this sounds like Sixus of, there was a Cincinnati Sixus family, Jewish, that was involved in the slave trade and in agitating for a civil war. So you see these Jewish names pop up in the history of the slave trade and the history of the agitation for the American Civil War, with the vast majority of Jews where publicly announcing themselves supporting slavery and supporting secession. So the Jewish population of America in those days was not pro-liberty by any means. Pro-liberation, pro-emancipation of slaves by any means, folks. You would never know that to hear the Jews talk today. Because, of course, they're the liberators. You know, we're all liberated by communism. So as we discussed earlier, the slave castles on the western coast of Africa. Very interesting history. This is the culturetrip.com. Ghana's slave castles, the shocking story of the Ghanaian Cape Coast. And remember, we talked about the Sugar Coast, the Gold Coast, etc. And the Rum Coast. Take a close look at the coast of Ghana, and you will find myriad ancient castles and forts. Because none of these were built by blacks, or they may have used black labor to do the building. It was the Portuguese who first started building these castles. Marking the beginning of the slave's perilous journey during the era of the slave trade, these fortresses were the last memory slaves had of their homeland before being shipped off across the Atlantic, never to return again. Read more about the shocking history of Ghana's slave fortresses and their significance to modern-day Ghana. Well, actually, slavery is still practiced in Ghana by black Muslims. Between 1482 and 1786, clusters of castles and forts were erected along the 500-kilometer-long coastline of Ghana between Keta, K-E-T-A, in the east and Bayan in the west. Back then, Ghana was called the Gold Coast due to its vast quantities of gold, and these strongholds served as fortified trading posts offering protection from other foreign settlers and threats from the African population. Well, blacks didn't like to be slaves, right? So where they could, black tribes would attack these forts. Placed strategically as links in the trade routes established by the Portuguese in the 15th century, who were the first settlers on the Gold Coast. Obviously, they were brought there by gold, just as they were brought to America by gold. The forts thereafter were seized, attacked, exchanged, sold, and abandoned during almost four centuries of struggle between European powers for domination over the Gold Coast. So the Portuguese were the first, then the Spanish, then the British, the Dutch, of course. Maybe the Dutch preceded the British. And the last, and the French, also the French. And the last were the Germans, who had very little colonial presence in Africa. With the possible exception of Southwest Africa and some other places in North Africa, the Germans had the least presence as colonizers. As early as the 1500s, the 1500s, the settlers' interest turned to the slave trade in light of the growing demand for human labor in the New World, the Americas, and the Caribbean. From holding gold, ivory, and other wares, the castles gradually imprisoned slaves who were reduced to yet another commodity. The majestic fortresses along Ghana's breathtaking coast housed dark dungeons, overflowing with misery and despair, just like the slave ships. Right up until the slave trade was gradually abolished by each of the colonial powers in the first half of the 1800s. And as I told you, the British Empire abandoned slavery as a tactic because they couldn't rightly criticize the North while they themselves were practicing slavery. So the first thing they did was, I think it was 1833, they declared their opposition to slavery, and they paid themselves off really well at public expense for their slave holdings, cashed out, and then postured as anti-slavery people from that point forward. So they could agitate against slavery in the North, sending British agents here even before the War of 1812. And their presence here as radical abolitionists continued until the Civil War and afterwards even. So the two-faced nature of the British declaration against slavery is obvious when you realize it was done so they could pretend to be anti-slavery. They couldn't lecture the Americans without having given up slavery. So that's what they did. And of course, they were still in the banking business and the booze business and other businesses as well. So this was a totally chutzpah. It was chutzpah to suddenly declare yourselves to be anti-slavery when you had been making profits off of slavery for all these decades. So, and in each one of these, and of course the European powers were feeling getting the hint that serfdom was on its way out. And of course that was a form of slavery. So they were doing something that was politically advisable, not that they wanted to give up their slaves and serfs, but you know, the history was going in that direction. Slavery and serfdom were on their way out, and there was nothing they could do about it. But by this point, the irreversible and immeasurable damage was done, and from West Africa alone, it is estimated that 6 million slaves, there's that number 6 million again, that comes up all over the place, had been shipped to other countries. About 10 to 15% perished at sea during the so-called Middle Passage, never reaching their final destination. I would say it was probably higher than that. Anyway, this has some pictures of these Gold Coast mansions or fortresses. Again, this is from the website theculturetrip.com. And the title of the article is Ghana's Slave Castles, the Shocking Story of the Ghanaian Slave Coast. The castles were the ultimate stop in many ways. They provided the last experience that men and women had in their homeland before their final departure. For those who didn't make it to the New World, the castles were the last place they ever saw on land. The last shreds of hope would wither away with every day of captivity in the castle. You know, who knows how badly they were treated while in the castle, let alone on the ship. On the seaboard side of the coastal slave coast castles was the door of no return. Ooh, that sounds ominous. Return to what? Back to the prison? A portal through which the slaves were lowered into boats and then loaded like cargo onto big slaving ships further out at sea, never to set foot on their homeland again, and with a final goodbye to the freedom they once knew. With the extent to which Africans were free in their tribal situation is debatable. One of the most famous castles in Ghana's dark episode of slavery is the Cape Coast Castle. It began as a trade lodge constructed by the Portuguese in 1555 on a part of the Gold Coast, which later became known as the Cape Coast. In 1653, following Sweden's conquest of the Cape Coast, wow, I didn't know that the Swedish were involved. The Swedish Africa Company constructed a permanent wooden fortress for trade in timber and gold. A decade later, the fort was reconstructed in stone when the Danes seized power from the Swedish. Okay, yeah, this is all this business in gold caused wars, didn't it? The fort then passed through the hands of the Dutch and even a local Fetu chief at some point. Yeah, well, the blacks were in the slave business too, right? Don't forget that. Before being conquered by the British in 1664. And that's when the British really started getting heavily involved in the slave business. Over the years, the fort was increasingly used for the developing slave trade, which came to a peak in the 18th century. By 1700, the fort had been transformed into a castle and also served as the headquarters of the British colonial governor. Okay, and the fortress still stands. Nice piece of work. Up to 1,000 male and 500 female slaves were shackled and crammed into the castle's dank, poorly ventilated dungeons. In the black-run countries of Africa today, the prisons are still dank and poorly ventilated, with no space to lie down and very little light, just like the slave holds and the slave ships. Without water or sanitation, the floor of the dungeon was littered with human waste, and many captives fell seriously ill. I guess there were so many of them they didn't care that they survived or not. The men were separated from the women, and the captors regularly raped the helpless women, again contributing to the cause of amalgamation. The castle also featured confinement cells, small pitch-black spaces for prisoners who revolted or were seen as rebellious. Okay, the hole. You go to the hole. Once the slaves set foot in the castle, they could spend up to 3 months in captivity under these dreadful conditions before being shipped off to the New World in potentially even worse conditions. It looks like a spa from the sea, right? With the Spanish design. A chateau on the southern coast of Spain. That's what it looks like, but it's in Ghana. An environment of harsh contrasts. The castle also had some extravagant chambers, devoid of the stench and misery of the dungeons, only a couple of meters below. For example, the British governor and officers' quarters were spacious and airy, with beautiful parquet floors and scenic views of the blue waters of the Atlantic. There was also a chapel inside the castle enclosure for the officers, traders, and their families as they went about their normal day-to-day life completely detached from the unfathomable human suffering they were consciously inflicting. Of course, this article doesn't mention anything about Jews being involved in the slave trade. The castle's involvement with slavery eventually stopped as a result of Britain's ban on the slave trade. Cape Coast Castle went back to its previous function as an essential site for non-human commodity trade, after which it was turned into an army training facility. In 1957, when Ghana became the first African state to regain independence from British colonial rule, the ownership of the Cape Coast was transferred to the new government and subsequently to the Ghana Museums and Monuments Board. Well, tourist attraction now. The castle only underwent considerable restoration work in the early 1990s with the help of donor funds and is currently a well-visited museum and historical site. And Obama visited the Cape Coast dungeons in honor of his ancestors. I don't know whether it's his white ancestors or his black, Jewish white ancestors. And or black ancestors. He might have had slave owners in his ancestry too. Another famous slave castle is the Elmina Castle, often called St. George's Castle, situated in the town of Elmina, about 13 kilometers from the Cape Coast Castle. Known as the oldest European structure in Ghana, the castle's construction began in 1482. Following the arrival of the Portuguese on the Gold Coast in 1471, and served to protect the Portuguese settlement area named São Jorge da Mina, St. George of the Mines. Over the decades, various parts of the castle were rebuilt with trade remaining its main focus. However, the west coast of Africa had its gold rush, just as the west coast of America did. However, by the 17th century, most of this trade was in people. In 1637, the Dutch seized control of the Gold Coast and continued to use the Elmina Castle as a place to store slaves until their departure. Now, we know that the Dutch East India Company and the Dutch West India Company were owned by Jews. But since this article is designed for tourist consumption, no such mention of Jewish involvement in those two businesses is forthcoming. The Dutch made some substantial changes to the castle, such as setting up a marketplace where slaves could be auctioned. The conditions were similar to that of the neighboring Cape Coast castle. In the dungeons, light could only enter through... Oh, in the dungeons, should be a comma there. In the dungeons, light could only enter through the doorways or a few small holes at either end of the ceiling. I guess it was hot enough that you didn't have to have heating and you could let air in, but I bet the nights were cold. Any revolt was harshly disciplined. Men were sent to the condemned cell with no lighting and were starved to death, while women were beaten and chained to cannonballs in the courtyard. Mindful of possible attacks, the Dutch built a bastion, Fort Konradsburg, also known as St. Jago, on the hill opposite Elmina Castle, which overlooked its big brother's House of Horrors. Yeah, slavery was brutal business, especially the capturing and transportation part of it. Under the rule of the Dutch West Indies Company, around 30,000 slaves a year passed through Elmina's door of no return, right up until 1814, when the Dutch slave trade was abolished, 7 years after the British. Ceded to the British in 1872, Elmina Castle was hardly in use until Ghana's independence. Thereafter, it became a training center for Ghanaian police recruits and surprisingly a school for some time, before also being converted into a history museum. I wonder if the history instructor informed the listeners of the fact that blacks sold other blacks into slavery as part of the slave trade. Probably little or no mention of that. Other castles and forts that remain include Fort Christiansborg, or Osu Castle, the Usher Fort, and Fort James, or Fort James in those days. Besides museums, some fortresses have been transformed into government offices, prisons, and guest houses, while others are nothing more than abandoned stone ruins with a few walls standing. UNESCO has declared many of these castles and forts World Heritage Sites of great historical importance, because you must have these sites standing to blame whites for slavery. However, due to limited funding, preservation has been limited, and the sites continue to deteriorate. So let's all go to Ghana and be tourists to help to help keep these forts and castles from rotting. Today, 30-odd surviving forts, castles, and former trading posts can be found along Ghana's coast, many bearing witness to the largest forced migration in history and to the atrocities humanity is capable of committing. Well, such as... the blacks exterminating white farmers in South Africa. Let's not forget that. Castles such as Elmina, Cape Coast, and Usher Fort have turned into museums and offer guided tours. So 4,000 or 5,000 will get you there. Thanks for listening, folks.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message. Take a look around, kid. What do you see? Homes being foreclosed. People working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country is founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to the banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means. This is our bank. This is our war. And this is our plan of attack.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy. So consider this justice.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution, Revolution. Radio!
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Join me weekdays for my new show, Tell Chris Joe. It's going to be a problem show brought to you live from Kensington. Thursdays, I'm dealing with hot topics, heated debate, what's new around the world, and ring-ins to discuss listeners' problems and offering considered and heartfelt solutions. So join me, Chris Hart, for Tell Chris Joe. Stop what you're doing, grab a cup of tea, and coming live from Kensington. Relax. Let me entertain you with a coffee bar online. Listeners, very personal problems. So that's Thursdays, 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. See you there. It's going to be lots of fun.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener.